I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
You're listening to Pandemic, a podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungine, and each week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. Sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat. The correspondents and I will be recording this in many cases on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Thursday, April 8th, episode 83 of Pandemic. And for this podcast, we're going to look at an international response to the crisis, specifically that of the UN and the UN Security Council. The UN covers areas such as aid and development and human rights, but at the beginning of this year, Ireland became a non-permanent or elected member of the UN Security Council. That's the arm of the UN that deals with peace and security and sets the mandates for peacekeeping missions. So what can the UN Security Council do to help tackle COVID-19, and what could Ireland do within that? That's what I've been discussing for this episode with Richard Gowan, the UN Director with the International Crisis Group, an organisation that describes itself as being dedicated to working towards preventing wars and shaping policies that would build a more peaceful world. That's up next. Okay, Richard Gowan, you are UN Director with the International Crisis Group, and thanks for joining us on the Pandemic podcast.
It's great to join you.
The UN Security Council's handling of the pandemic thus far you've described as an embarrassment, but is the Security Council the place where you might expect the pandemic to be discussed, or only where the pandemic intersects with security issues?
Look, the Security Council is not qualified to dictate international medical policy. What the Council can do is, firstly, look at how to deal with the virus in areas where there is conflict, for example, in Africa or in the Middle East, and also just give a general sense of leadership and unity around COVID-19. And sadly, that sense of leadership and unity was badly lacking in 2020 because the Trump administration didn't want to work through the UN during the initial phase of the health crisis.
Right. You describe in March 2020, there was an effort made to try and reach some form of resolution to break through into areas that were beset by conflict to try to extend humanitarian aid, but it fell victim to bickering. Could you just go into that briefly? What happened? And then what happened a year later?
Well, back in March last year, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for a global ceasefire to help aid workers get medical assistance to people in conflict areas facing COVID-19. And that was a very powerful call. It got a huge amount of public support. I think more than 2 million people signed an online petition backing it. But the Security Council couldn't endorse it for months on end. And the reason for that was the Trump administration simply refused to accept any language in a Security Council resolution mentioning the WHO. Now, the Biden administration has come in, and Biden's team are obviously far more positive towards the WHO than the Trump administration was. So there is a bit of space for the Security Council to up its game now.
So the personalities of the presidents, the successive US presidents, actually had an impact. I think in the commentary you wrote for the International Crisis Group, you describe a situation where there was an insistence even by the Americans to include the term Wuhan virus.
Yes, the Trump administration, especially in the early months of the crisis, was simply looking for ways to distract from its own, you know, poor domestic handling of the disease. And so across international forums, including in the Security Council, the US was really focused on trying to embarrass China. Using language like Wuhan virus was clearly going to make serious diplomacy impossible. It's worth saying that in July last year, the Council did finally pass a resolution endorsing the global ceasefire idea, but nothing has happened about it because I think it was obvious, you know, even to governments and armed groups that took the ceasefire concept seriously, that the UN wasn't giving it any real top-level backing.
And the situation has changed. Now we're talking about provision of vaccines to areas, whereas heretofore it might have been trying to improve healthcare facilities or provide personal protective equipment. But when it comes to the change that happened, is the change of administration in the US key, or was there just simply pressure on all of the actors on the UN Security Council, driven by the scale of the death toll around the world and in their own domestic agendas?
I think that if President Trump had stayed in office, if we were in a Trump second term, the Security Council would not be talking about COVID-19 at all. I think that Trump's anti-multilateral agenda made discussions of the pandemic pretty useless at the UN. But what has changed is that after Biden came into office, after Biden indicated very clearly he wanted to restore global cooperation around the pandemic, other council members have been trying to think of ways to get some of the momentum that they didn't have last year. And last month, back in February, the UK tabled a resolution re-endorsing the concept of the global ceasefire in principle, but more specifically calling for localized ceasefires in war zones, so that the WHO and other health organizations can get vaccines into those conflict zones. There's a long history of humanitarian pauses to allow for vaccination campaigns for other diseases like polio, and now the Security Council is suggesting something similar for COVID-19.
Right, a successful history?
It is a successful history. I mean, obviously, the record is mixed, but when medical ceasefires can be arranged with conflict parties, the results can be really quite impressive. There was one case in Sudan, I think about 15, 16 years ago, where health workers were able to administer about 5 million polio vaccines during a humanitarian pause that the UN had negotiated. And, even in countries like Afghanistan, where, you've had horrible conflicts for many years, medical ceasefires have sometimes been quite effective.
There is going to be a delay in follow-up to this one because of the vaccine supply, which isn't in and of itself a bad thing, but you can make a virtue of necessity, you argue, by using the delay on the supply of vaccines to effectively plan what can be done if the ceasefires are achieved.
Exactly. I mean, the resolution that was passed on vaccines last month was moved quite quickly, I think primarily because the diplomats wanted to show goodwill. It was one of the first big discussions of an international issue after the change of administration in the US, and everyone wanted a quick win. But the reality is that before you start distributing vaccines, before you start talking about vaccine ceasefires, you first need to be sure that you have the necessary supplies to ship to places like Yemen and Congo. Now, big problems in vaccine distribution, especially the fact that India has paused exports, are holding up potential vaccine supplies to conflict-affected countries. So this concept, if it ever becomes a reality, is probably going to be a few months down the road.
Although the traditional competition or animosities on the UN Security Council could actually play well on this one, in that you have competing vaccine suppliers, all of whom may try and get a win through vaccine diplomacy. So there may ultimately, once a surplus is developed, be an eagerness to roll out vaccines to countries that are affected by conflicts, in which UN Security Council players may be playing other roles.
That's true. And, a lot of the major vaccine producers are on the council, China, India, Russia. And, for them, being seen to supply vaccines to conflict-affected areas, as well as poorer countries more generally, would obviously be a public relations win.
You say that adjusting peacekeeping mandates to protect vaccination teams is something very practical that the UN Security Council could look at. What kind of a role would you see, or what kind of a tweaking to peacekeeping mandates would you envisage there?
Now, this is something for which there are precedents in areas like West Africa and the Democratic Republic of Congo, where you've had Ebola outbreaks and UN peacekeepers have been asked to assist in the response to Ebola. What peacekeepers can do is firstly provide logistical support to health workers. Peacekeeping operations have planes, trucks, and other assets that can be used to help the WHO and its partners. In some cases, the peacekeepers can actually provide physical security to health workers going into regions where they might come under threat. Also, UN peace operations include political experts, mediators, who can quietly reach out to combatants and negotiate humanitarian space in advance of vaccine drives.
And on the security area, though, you would counsel caution on taking that too far, as in robust security engagement in the interests of protecting people who are rolling out vaccine supply.
Well, I don't think anyone is suggesting that you should start bombing pathways down which people can then roll out vaccines. I mean, I think most of the work will be more on the logistical side, more on the political side. The UN has actually also done quite a good job in the last year of adapting its peace operations to help weaker countries respond to COVID. The UN has provided protective equipment in the early days. It's become quite expert in public information campaigns in fragile areas, explaining the basics of COVID to vulnerable populations. So, the military dimension is one part of it. But peacekeepers can do a lot more than just provide security.
Syria is one area that you say is going to be a testing ground, particularly the areas outside of regime control. And within that, Idlib, the point of access across the Turkish border, has now been limited, I think, to one border crossing. And there is some amount of argument on the Security Council over control of points of access, control of distribution of aid. Maybe you tease out some of those issues and what kind of a difficulty it might throw up in terms of UN Security Council cooperation.
I think this is a real potential problem. You have a huge debate in the Security Council now over the rules of humanitarian aid in general in Syria. Russia is trying to ensure that the Assad regime has control over all aid flows around the country, including into rebel-held areas. And I can easily see the rollout of vaccines becoming part of that broader debate. If, for example, Russia and China were to give Assad a large amount of vaccines, they might also insist that Assad should be responsible for their distribution to non-government controlled areas. That's something which could easily turn into a row in the Security Council. And I would note that Ireland, as a elected member of the council, is going to be quite heavily involved in these discussions because Ireland and Norway are the diplomatic coordinators of debates around assistance to Syria.
Right. Any tips for Ireland in that regard in exercising their mandate on the Security Council in how they might achieve agreement?
Well, the Irish have a great team. You have a great team here in New York, so do the Norwegians, and it's been absolutely obvious from the start of your term in the Security Council that this is an area where you need to focus and prioritise. I mean, I think the key thing in the vaccine debate is to try to minimise its politicisation, to talk quietly to the Russians and to others and say, this is not something which you should attempt to instrumentalize. I mean, the politics around anything to do with Syria at the UN is awful. But I think that it's key that there's some sort of quiet discussion about at least preserving a degree of impartiality about this aspect of aid.
Right. And overall, with regard to the UN Security Council's role in tackling COVID-19, you argue Security Council members should, insofar as possible and insofar as it's advisable, just take a step back and let humanitarian experts on the ground get on with the job.
Wherever possible, yes. I mean, the Security Council doesn't need to interfere in every single humanitarian operation, even where there is conflict. I mean, the optimal way to set up a humanitarian ceasefire is through quiet diplomacy on the ground, not through the Security Council making loud statements. But I can see cases where the Council could order pre-existing UN peacekeeping forces to assist in vaccine distribution, as we were saying. And that's something which, again, Ireland might be able to inform because of Ireland's long history in peacekeeping. And then sometimes, the Council can back up humanitarian efforts by making public statements, praising those armed groups that actually do help with vaccination and, condemning those that don't. So I think the Council, it's playing a quarterback role, if you will, backing up a much bigger humanitarian effort to distribute vaccines for COVID-19. But it can still be helpful.
Okay. Richard Gowan, UN Director with the International Crisis Group. Thanks very much for talking to us on Pandemic. Pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much indeed.
And that's our lot for another episode of Pandemic. You can get in touch with me with questions, suggestions or observations at colm.omongain@rte.ie. That's colm.omongain@rte.ie. At Colm Omongain on Twitter. And you can leave a review or subscribe on your podcast platform of choice. Until next week, take care, stay safe. And thanks as always for listening.